We're really honored to have Gail Sulick here tonight, the author of Pink Ribbon Blues. She's a sociologist. She graduated from SUNY Albany with a PhD in sociology and worked extensively with women in the Capital District, Crabb in particular, and Professor Pat Brown from the biology department. And so we're really honored to have her here to talk about her work, something that we feel very, very passionate about. So Gail Sulick.
Started back in 2001, actually. So it's been many years in the making, and at that point I was doing a lot of work with Capital Region Action Against Breast Cancer, and with Joan Sheehan and Bonnie Spanier, Margaret Roberts, Pat Brown, and many people. Michelle Kelleher, I see in the audience. It's so wonderful to have familiar faces here, and this work has been so long coming, and any of you who know me know I've been talking about it ad nauseum for all these years. And so it culminated in this book that I'm very excited about, and it really took on a life of its own that I couldn't have imagined when I first started doing this research. It really came started with the idea of just, you know, what is it that women face when they are diagnosed with breast cancer and when they hear those words? And out of that came an analysis that was much bigger than I had anticipated. So what I'm going to share with you tonight are some images, quite a few images actually, that represent some of the key themes that are in the book and that comprise what has really become an entire culture, an entire system that is organized around the cause of breast cancer. Some of them will probably look very familiar to you, others may look new to you, and my hope is that they will instigate and provoke a deep conversation about what it means to advocate for breast cancer. So what you see on the screen right now are some of the typical images of pink culture. First and foremost, we see the pink. So we could ask ourselves, what does it mean to pink a disease, to pink an illness? And certainly femininity is an important aspect of this. We see images of survivorship. We see the war on cancer, the war on breast cancer in particular. And we see images of solidarity. Those are all things that developed out of the breast cancer movement. And from that movement, we know what the positives are. We know the positive outcomes that arose out of many decades of advocacy. Certainly there is visibility of the disease. We know about it. I don't think there is anyone who doesn't know about breast cancer and the fact that women are at risk for breast cancer. We know that people have come together around the cause of breast cancer and that there is a sense of connection among people fighting for this cause. We know that out of the breast cancer movement, which started really out of the women's health movement and the women's movement of the 1970s, that women's health became a priority largely because breast cancer became a priority. The image of the survivor is not only important as a personal story, but the survivor increased its status or her status over the years in breast cancer advocacy. Women no longer had to hide what had been a very stigmatized disease, and survivorship of the person became very, very important. We also know that out of survivorship came an entire movement toward involving women in research and the consumer, the medical consumer in research, and that had a major impact on the kinds of research that had been done. There has been improvement in treatment. That's a good thing that many agree on. There has certainly been a lot of fundraising to the tune of about $6 billion per year at this point. And we know that there is widespread support for the cause, the general cause of breast cancer. But beyond all of that, the industry, the culture, the system that is in place around breast cancer is multifaceted. It isn't one just thing. It isn't the etiology of the disease. It isn't biology and just what is the next treatment or the next clinical trial. There is an entire system that involves culture,
and a political system. Which research projects get funded and which ones don't, for example? The advocacy movement, as I already discussed. Mass media. The illness as it exists today could not exist without mass media. And much of what we see, much of the imagery we see, is transmitted for a mass audience. We see an industry that lies beneath it, profit centers, revenue centers, that rely not only on breast cancer, but on other cancers as well, for profit streams. Again, the role of survivors. And within the role of survivors, there has been an ongoing counter-pink culture as well, a negotiation of what it means to have breast cancer, what it means to be a survivor, and what it means to support the cause. And most importantly for me in this book is the idea of data. How is it that we can assess where we stand in the fight against breast cancer? How do we know if we're achieving our goals? And how does that information make its way to the public? We might be having a few technical difficulties tonight. I think that image will show up. One of the things that we think about in terms of the goal of breast cancer advocacy is that we all want to see the eradication of the disease. We all want to see cure. And Larry Norton of Sloan Kettering Medical Center has said on numerous occasions that he believes that a little girl born today will not have to worry about breast cancer in her future. So how do we assess that? Well, one thing that we may consider is looking at incidence rates. Are incidence rates actually going down? And what we tend to see with breast cancer is that incidence rates either remain slightly level or they tend to go up. And this year, or 2009, to over 250,000 cases of breast cancer in the United States. We know that that number has gone up since the 1940s. And importantly, we also know that the decline that we have seen, which was a slight decline in incidence, was actually the result of women no longer using hormone replacement therapy, which was later found to cause not only breast cancer, but heart disease, stroke, and other negative health outcomes. The 1 in 8 statistic is one that we see a lot, the idea that 1 in 8 women in her lifetime will be diagnosed with breast cancer. And when we see that statistic, it promotes a lot of concern, a lot of fear among women, because often we read that as if there are 8 of you sitting in a row, one of you will get breast cancer. Well, in fact, that number accumulates over the life course. So the number is actually, at the age of 39, 1 in 204 women, not in 1 in 8. So how is it that we understand those statistics? Importantly, to know about the 1 in 8 statistic is that in 1975, it was 1 in 11. So that tells us that over time, there have been greater incidences of breast cancer, and there's something going on in our social, cultural, environmental system that may be contributing to that. We might also consider survival rates if we're looking at the progress and how a child today may or may not have to worry or be concerned about breast cancer in the future. When we look at survival statistics, often the ones we see more recently tend to go over to the other side or combine these two columns, the invasive and the non-invasive breast cancers. But there are really important distinctions between these two types of cancer. The one on the left, the invasives, are the ones that have the capacity to spread, can take over your body, increase mortality due to breast cancer. 77% of all diagnosed fall into that category. But on the other side are the non-invasive cancers, the ones that do not have a tendency to spread, would not be considered life-threatening. And 23% of all cases fall into that category. And if you think about it, it really makes sense that if you don't have what is considered to be a life-threatening cancer, well, your survival rate would probably go up closer to that 100. But if you're on the other side and have a type that is invasive, that is life-threatening, those survival rates might be lower. And we see that after 20 years, 60% of women diagnosed with an invasive form of breast cancer die after 20 years from breast cancer. Cancer will be diagnosed in 1 out of 7, because that number has shifted 7, 8, and 9. But now 97.5% will survive. Research makes the difference. And it puts forward this notion that we're making a lot of progress with regard to breast cancer. But when you break down those survival rates, you see that the progress really falls into a particular category of breast cancer. And one of the reasons we can't really count on 5-year survival statistics for this disease is recurrence. And recurrence, when a breast cancer returns or a new one develops, happens 1/3 of the time for women diagnosed with that invasive type of breast cancer. And those recurrences can happen after the 5-year point. So many women have said to me, "I don't know if I'm a survivor until I die from something else." And I hear that a lot. And what I wanted to point attention to in terms of mortality, breast cancer is the second cause of cancer death among women after lung cancer, but heart disease kills more women than breast cancer or lung cancer as well. So when we think about women's health and women's health risks, we need to think about all of those things together. The mortality rates have remained and hovered around 40,000 for women and around a few hundred for men every year. What I wanted to point attention to here is that in 1991, on average, there were 117 deaths per day from breast cancer. And in 2009, it dropped to 110. So we might think, well, that's some progress, and it is. That's 7 fewer deaths per day. But if we consider what that would mean over a period of time, how many years would it take if we go at that rate to eliminate risk of death to breast cancer? It would take about 500 years, and that doesn't even consider the incidence of breast cancer. The National Breast Cancer Coalition released a statement in the end of September stating that they have given up on hope and that they have given up on awareness, because to them, all of those statistics suggest incremental progress with regard to breast cancer, and that is not good enough. They suggest that we need more collaborative action and research that would move toward the elimination of the disease. So we might consider then, what is it that is limiting or maybe limiting our progress? Those non-invasive cancers, the 23%, the ones that are not considered to be life-threatening, one of the examples of that is ductal carcinoma in situ, or DCIS. And there's been a lot of controversy about this particular type of cancer. And last year at the San Antonio Symposium, doctors and researchers came together and said, you know, we regret that the term carcinoma is in this label. This is not life-threatening, but we treat it as if it were. So women with DCIS have been given mastectomies, lumpectomies, radiation, and what doctors and scientists have learned since then is that they may have been overtreated. They were not at risk of death from the disease. We can move on from that. If you have questions about that, we can talk about it later on. Another issue that I'm sure you've heard a lot about, and especially if you get Crabb's newsletter, is the controversy around mammography screening and whether or not that screening should happen at age 50 or age 40. And even though that might seem like news, it's actually not news to the scientific community, and there have been discussions about it since the 1970s, in fact. What has been found is that there are high rates of false positives. Images on a mammogram that actually, upon biopsy, do not indicate cancer. There are also a higher number than expected percentage of false negatives, 25 to 40%. So things that actually are cancerous don't show up on the mammogram. Overall, population statistics, mortality, reduction due to population screening is only 10 to 15%. And so people then wonder, you know, if we rely only on this screening tool to save us from breast cancer, well, we've got our work cut out for us because the tool itself has some problems in terms of letting us know what it is we're detecting. Gilbert Welch has come forth on this pretty strongly and had a book in 2004 called Should I Be Tested for Cancer? And he not only looked at breast cancer screening but also prostate screening and argued that we're over-screening and over-diagnosing and over-treating people just because we have this technology. In 2008, 81% of women had up-to-date screening as was called for the Preventative Task Force, which last year came forward and said, we recommend that women get mammograms every 2 years after the age of 50 instead of every year at age 40. Often, though, you're not going to see that information. The public is not going to know what it is behind the screening guidelines, and instead, you're going to get advertisements like this. All your friends are doing it, shouldn't you? And this is an ad from a mammography center. So instead of getting the information out to the public so that they can consider and assess the risks and benefits of the screening test, we often don't get that information at all. We also have an interest in big pharma, huge pharmaceutical companies that have revenue streams that depend on oncology drugs. There are 60 drugs right now approved for breast cancer and about 100 more in the pipeline. Oncology drugs surpassed cholesterol drugs in 2009 as the top seller. And in 2012, the global drug market, the oncology drugs are approaching $75 to $80 billion. So if we ask ourselves, what is it that medical research is doing? When we look at the pharmaceutical industry, we see lots of recomposition, recombining of existing drugs with existing patents rather than the development of new drugs. Those are called me-too drugs. But we also see that sometimes the drugs that are put forth actually cause harm. And recently you may be aware of the drug Avastin, which came onto the market, was approved by the FDA based on one study. One study. And it was designed to stop blood flow to tumors. But the harms that came out of that were pretty extreme and did not increase the life expectancy for people who were given the drug. Instead, we see mass marketing teams for Avastin come forth. And according to PharmExec, the biggest hurdle facing any professional marketing team is making dry scientific facts and figures pop. And as you can tell from my presentation of scientific statistics, that's really hard. The team at Harrison and Starr, which is shown here, which was the team that developed the marketing for Avastin, used cutting-edge graphics and stellar filmmaking to create 3D animation of Avastin's mechanism of action. It made a splash on the convention floor, and attendees had the chance to wear purple 3D glasses to watch the sophisticated thrill ride through the body and close up with the drug's mechanisms of action. So we might consider if perhaps Genentech had put as much effort into researching the drug, it may not be recalled by the FDA in December, which is possible. And when it was started back in 1985, the name of the company was actually Zeneca. It was part of Imperial Chemical Industries, and they made petroleum-based products, which are known to be carcinogens. Zeneca later merged with Astra to become AstraZeneca, one of the largest pharmaceutical corporations, also responsible for the drug tamoxifen, which has been a standard drug therapy for 30 years for breast cancer. We may ask about that interest in promoting diagnosis and screening, and also then benefiting from the diagnosis and treatment of that disease. But again, you only can find out that information if you drill down into the website and look. Often, instead, we're going to be distracted. And what are we distracted by? Lots of pink, of course. But that also refers to a specific type of femininity in society. So what do we see? We see, what is women's place? We see that the cause itself is a moral cause, women coming together to fight for women, to support women. We see the importance of beauty in women's bodies. We see lifestyle, and very interesting pink lifestyle products have emerged in the last few years. We also see that the cause can be trivialized by the types of products that are sold in the name of the cause. And more recently, we're seeing sexualization of women for the cause as well.